I'm Jan Suk Fong Lee.
And I'm Dina Del Bucchia.
And this is Can't Lit.
Can't Lit. Talk about books and stuff.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey. Hey. What's up? Welcome to the podcast. Hey. Whoa. Things are getting wild in here. Could I be a DJ?
You sound like Chuck Woolery. Do you remember Chuck Woolery? Our guest... probably doesn't remember Chuck Woolery.
Probably not.
No, very few people know who Chuck Woolery is these days. That was my fireplace making a noise podcast listeners.
Great. If you heard it, I hope you enjoyed it.
The flame went out.
You know, it cools down and makes funny noises.
It's like a real, it felt like a real Ebenezer Scrooge thing to happen. You're hanging out, then all of a sudden the fire goes out, a couple of ghosts come in, they tell you that you're being a dick, you got to pull it together. It is December after all.
Yes, this is our...
So I am expecting ghosts from my past to appear at all times.
Real ghosts? Like ghosts? Or just people?
I don't know, Jen.
Because that's different.
Both.
I don't know if the podcast listeners know that I see dead people.
Yeah.
Do the podcast listeners know
I think
this?
You've talked about it, but I love when you talk about it.
I see dead people, but they're like related to me. But then I started thinking, maybe I see other dead people too. I just don't know they're dead because they're not related to me and I don't know that they're dead. So it could be that like 50% of the people I see in the world are actually dead people. I don't know. Like if it's my grandmother who's been dead for 30 years, then I get it because she's dead. Right. But like, right. If it's just some rando, I don't know if you're dead.
Right. You don't have a reference point.
No, you could be alive or dead. I don't know.
I'll tell you right now, 90% sure that our guest is alive.
Yay.
You never know though. You never know.
You never know. Shazia Hafiz Ramji, poet, writer, great person.
Ghost.
Editor, publisher, owner of great glasses, good hair,
a really good pullover. What are we going to call this? This pullover sweatshirt?
It's like a half zip
Henley type situation.
Like the coziest shirt you can wear.
It's my techno DJ pullover.
Oh my God. It's like Skrillex all of a sudden.
Look at this color block, white on black.
Oh, I like it. I like it. It's very good. We like to talk about clothes. And hair.
Yeah.
And style in general on the podcast.
We definitely do. See? Shazia, it has like a writerly uniform.
Do you really? Do you have a writerly uniform?
I've been told I have a uniform and people have asked, but I don't think it happened intentionally. I think it's because I wear stripes all the time or like black and white and red.
You just have like a color palette that you work in.
Yeah.
But not on purpose. It's just a color palette you're attracted to.
Just a color palette. Today morning, I was thinking of what to wear, and I put all my striped shirts on my bed, which is striped black and white and red. So I was like, everything's just camouflage. So, yeah.
You can't tell.
Very hard to decide.
I mean, I love stripes also.
And I red. As well.
Black, white. We're all wearing black and white and red today.
Black and white and red. I'm looking for a chevron striped duvet cover. This is my thing right now, but I haven't found a good one yet.
I will keep on the lookout.
Mm. Yeah.
Urban Outfitters might have a chevron duvet.
It's not the right color for me. I already looked at it. I want gray, like a light gray and white stripe because my room is kind of like that. I will accept a light blue or a light pink, maybe.
Okay.
But we're looking... Calm colors.
Right.
Calm. My bedroom's very calm. It's the room that my child is not really allowed in. So there's like, you know, calm. Anyway.
It is very light and bright.
It is. Yes. Shiny and bright.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's happening?
Dina? What is happening? Jen.
Dina.
Jen.
Do you want
this is good.
I just feel
like we go back and forth like this for a little bit.
For like an hour. And then all those CBC listeners who now listen to our podcast will be like, this is no good.
Like, what is happening on that podcast?
Electric Literature, CBC.
Oh, yeah,
Jen
Dina.
And Dina.
Dina, why don't you talk about that? That's what's happening. Talk
what's
about
happening
that.
Is that the podcast got some attention. The Leo-driven podcast got the attention it's so deliciously desired. And Jen was on The New Chapter talking to Sheila Rogers about the podcast. And we have had a lot of new subscribers and listeners. So hello, new listeners. We are so very, very happy to have you.
We're happy
Shout
to have.
Shout out to my mom.
Yeah. Hey, Shazia's mom.
Shout out to Shazia's mom.
Just welcome. You guys are all friends of the podcast now.
New friends of the podcast.
Yeah.
New listeners. And yeah, we were also included on a list of podcasts that are not hosted by three straight white dudes.
Which we are not hosted by. It's true.
We are not. And that was on Electric Literature, which is American. Ooh. So feels, you know, when I was trying to do my hair, I was like, oh, I just, like, my style guide for today is Marissa Tomei and My Cousin Vinny with the big hair.
Which, it's a good style guide to have.
Such a good style guide. Yeah. So then today I was looking online at all her outfits from the film, which are all amazing. But yeah, she wears a cat suit where she does her big monologue where she's yelling at Joe Pesci about her biological clock ticking. And she's like stomping on the old wooden like porch of this old country house that they have to be in because they are in the South for unknown reasons from New Jersey or wherever they're coming from.
And
their gigantic Cadillac.
Yeah.
And it's just one of the most iconic looks.
It's a floral cat suit with an open back and a mock neck. Yeah, and a mock neck.
And she has huge hair, not bangs, but like the front of her hair is just like pulled back into this like huge poof. And she has huge earrings.
She's so good.
It's just like a beautiful big look.
She's so great.
And she wears a lot of tight, short dresses in the movie. Yeah.
I think it's just this is great. Good. I fully endorse this like direction you're going in. I'm into
2019.
It.
Yeah.
Watch out.
So yeah, you've got your uniform. I'm moving in a new direction for 2019. So yeah, as I approach 40, this is how I'm feeling. I'm feeling Marissa Tomei, 1992.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good way to usher in perimenopause.
That was a formative year for me, you know?
Yeah.
Your book that's coming out is also about big things,
It is about big things. That's true. So I like the cohesion of look to match. I also got new author photos, and I'm wearing, like, really big prints in them. I have, a tiger print outfit and a leopard print outfit and really bright red lips.
It really goes with your megafauna.
Yeah, megafauna situation.
Yeah.
So... yeah, I guess I'm going big or I'm going home.
I feel like this is a perennial thing for you though. Go big or go home.
It is. And I just am changing the aesthetic slightly as the years go by.
But the bigness has not changed.
No, keep it big. Yeah. But I mean, I do love small things like tiny animals. And
Rosie.
Rosie. Rosie was really into Shazia when she got here.
Oh yeah. That's for everyone, every guest that Rosie has not liked right away. She really likes Shazia
We need to make it an official segment.
Did Rosie like you right away?
Yeah.
Or did it take her 20 minutes to warm up?
I do feel like people expect these updates.
She licked Shazia's tights.
Yeah.
Multiple times.
She ran between my legs and Shazia's legs and licked our tights. And it was the best.
It's a sign of love.
It's really cute.
Yeah. And also like...
I love her teeth.
You know what we haven't talked about? Oh, Rosie's underbite. I mean, it makes her look sometimes angry. It makes her look sometimes confused. But, you know, her underbite's pretty funny. We have not talked about this Chinatown otter.
Oh, do you want to talk about it?
I don't know. I mean, I was not thought you might want to talk about it.
There was an otter in Chinatown. Now it left.
Yeah, well, no one can find it.
But they all look the same. How are they going to find that one? They didn't tag it or anything.
He's walking around with like a koi head in his
He's
backpack.
Wearing it like around his neck. That's the only way they'll know. But it was also sort of around the same time that the otter went into Dr. Sun Yat-sen's garden in Chinatown and ate a bunch of very precious, beautiful koi.
Which makes me sad.
It is extremely sad.
Because the koi were beautiful and old. Like that one was like 53 or something.
I just don't know why they didn't take the koi out earlier.
Well, they tried to. Remember they couldn't find the koi were hiding?
Because the otter and people had been walking around in the pond so much.
So they were all hiding under whatever vegetation is in the pond, I think.
Poor koi.
Right at the very bottom.
Yeah.
And they've never been so... I think scared.
But I don't think they've ever been disrupted that way.
No. And I just remember watching that one news story on CBC and the whole segment opened with a shot of like an eviscerated koi body.
It's just lying on the side. Yeah.
And I was like, there was no warning that it was going to be graphic. I was like, that's a lot.
No, it's all of the photos of the dead koi were really upsetting.
They were quite upsetting. But then I only ever saw one shot of the actual otter.
There were a few photos of
it. Were there?
Mm-hmm.
And there was that one photo I saw where the otter's looking straight at the camera with like a real pissy look on his face. Like just, yeah, what up? And he had like a funny little mustache. Like,
they all have they're very whiskery.
But I felt like he had like an actual grayish, whitish mustache.
It's totally possible that he did.
Like he kind of looked like James Brolin to me, like, but in an otter. Of all the people to choose, James Brolin.
The good news is that the koi did reproduce.
Yes.
And so now as a result of this, I mean, obviously, terrible massacre. Very smart otter. Obviously, I love it. But I also love these beautiful fish. Mm-hmm. And they were really trying to get the koi to spawn, and they did. So I think they have like 300 koi babies.
Really?
Yeah. Oh.
That's good.
So the good news is they ended up, as a result of like draining the pond and doing all this other stuff, discovering that there were baby koi in the pond.
Oh,
so that's good.
That makes me happy.
Yeah. So, I mean, Madonna was one of the oldest koi. She was like 50. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know if they are supposed to live that long.
She's 53.
Or was 53.
53. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What are the other names?
I don't know if the other ones had names.
She was the ones that were, Madonna, the koi was the one that like the people who took care of the garden were closest to. I think that they had like relationships with her. Like maybe she was really friendly. I'm not entirely sure, but they had relationships with
her.
And
I think she also was just more noticeable. She was big. She mm-hmm. was, yeah. She was just a special, real special lady.
Yeah. I mean, R.I.P.
R.I.P. Koi.
Madonna, the koi.
But otter, I mean, it's really hard to not see you as a real metaphor for the way Vancouver, both the koi and the otter, for the way Vancouver treats the natural world, but also old people. So
old people who are established residents.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a neighborhood quickly gentrifying.
Holy. And then obviously the otter is someone who's, you know, scraping to stay alive.
Yeah.
As we all do. And the koi are, yeah, the elder residents.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's fucked up.
Yeah.
Fiction 101 with Dina.
Come to my non-existent fiction class.
Okay, can I use that for my fiction class?
Yeah
okay.
I really did think about it a lot.
I did too.
While it was happening.
I thought about it a ton.
It was also king tide around the same time, which is when the tide is super high.
I love the king tide.
I do too. It's also a lot easier to see otters during king tide because when the tide's not going out as much, they're playing way closer to the shore all the time. So if you want to do otter spotting, I feel like king tide is the best time. Just to let people know. If you want to get your otter sightings on, yeah. Second Beach is popular around that bay.
I saw a bunch of them around Cole Harbor.
Oh, yeah. They are there too?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's probably where the otter came from, like that side.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Instead of, maybe it came from Falls Creek, but Falls Creek is extremely dirty, and I feel like even otters are too smart for that.
I feel like this otter, it doesn't really matter where he came from, he really did walk across downtown Vancouver to get
there
to that garden.
There were multiple photos of the otter that people snapped where he's just running across the street. Like, he's like, and then friend of the podcast, Zina Sharman. Did we talk about this last time? No, we didn't, because we haven't recorded since
No.
then. Zina Sharman. No, it was before the Refuse launch. We must have talked about this. Told us. Yeah, we talked about it last time.
Oh, she saw it
she
on
saw
Pender
it
Street.
That morning, running down Pender Street being chased by crows. So we didn't even really know about the otter massacre at the time of our last recording.
No, we just knew there was an otter running down Pender Street.
Yeah.
This otter, though.
Pure massacre. Pure massacre. What's happening with you?
Me? Well, I mean, I've been writing this like essay on YouTube makeup tutorials, which has defeated me because I've realized that I love them so much that I have no critical thinking skills when it comes to YouTube makeup tutorials.
I'm happy to help you find some criticisms.
Oh, no, there are criticisms and I find them and I intellectually understand them, but then also I can't write about them because I love them too much. They're like the thing that I watch every night before I go to bed so that I can sleep. But in the research for this, I was looking up like like makeup influencers who are holding brands to task for their shade range, like for skin color, matching skin tone. And there's this one influencer named Jackie Ina, and she is testing this line of foundations, and she swatches it on her skin, and she's like, "That's not even fucking human. That's Donald Trump's summer color." And I was like, "Oh, sweet mother of God, that is so funny." So that's what's happening with me. I was laughing about someone yelling, "That's Donald Trump's summer color."
I mean, I feel like you should definitely include that. That should be the epigraph of the essay.
The essay currently is titled Glowing Up, because I talk about how makeup influenced me from 14 and then so glowing up, growing up, whatever, right? And yes, and so it should be Glowing Up, colon, that's Donald Trump's summer color.
I think you have good options.
That's all that's really been happening with me.
You really have been working on that essay for a while.
Yeah, because I can't write it. It's like, it's I have a draft right now. It's fine. I mean, I don't hate
Mercury's still in retrograde, Jen.
I don't know. Maybe something's going to happen.
Just sleep on it a couple more times.
Maybe I'll just throw some highlighter on the essay. Like, just print it out. Throw some highlighter on it, and it'll be magical.
Get a highlighting stick. Get some glitter.
Just glitter. A little glitter pot. Just dump it all over it.
What's that MAC stuff that you can put on that, like, is the shimmer?
Oh, what's that stuff called?
I forget what it's called.
I don't know. But like,
that, smear that on it.
The Charlotte Tilbury Flawless Hollywood Filter. That stuff. I know. See, I watch too many tutorials. Do you like how I know what it's called?
I love it so much.
I actually had a conversation with Sonara, a friend of the podcast, former guest, former guest, because she's on Twitter talking about like transition shades and eyeshadow. And I texted her and we were discussing this for quite some time. Cut creases, transition shades. And I'm like, what do you got to do, man? I got like Asian eyes. My eyelid real estate is limited, like limited.
Yeah. You got to maximize what you got. Anyway, great. Jessie, do you have any makeup tips?
Do I have any makeup tips? I wear eyeliner all the time, especially when I've not slept.
Black eyeliner.
Yeah. Leftovers from the goth days.
Yeah. Wait, can you please tell us about your goth look?
Ooh, we love early. Ooh.
We love to hear about earlier style trends of our guests.
I pretty much wore the same thing.
Okay, so just did you have different makeup?
I used to wear way more eyeliner on the top lid, and more heavily on the bottom lid too.
Oh yeah, the bottom lid is a goth hallmark.
Totally.
Yeah.
I like a heavy bottom lid though. Even
I do too. Yeah. Shazia, what's happening with you?
I got a milk frother, and I've been making London Fogs every day.
Oh, they're the best.
What's a milk? Is it a standalone tool? What's a milk frother?
Yes, it's a standalone tool, and it's $5 from IKEA. The IKEA $5. Name is Product with the K. And it's got like a spirally thing on the end, and it's battery operated, and you turn it on, you just froth up the milk. And then you get double bergamot tea, steep the tea in a half cup of water, and then add the frothy milk on top. And it's just amazing London Fog. So good.
I need one of those.
Yeah.
I need one of those. That's a good what's happening. That's a good tip.
I feel like cooking since I got back from tour, I've just been so excited about all the cooking utensils. I just want to feel at home so much.
Let's talk about your tour, because you've been everywhere. So where have you been in the last, I want to say, 2 months? A month?
Yeah. I was in Victoria in September, and then I read with Laura Ritland and Kayla Zaga and Nicholas Bradley and Neil Serkin, who's a really great poet. That was fun. We all went to the James Joyce pub afterwards after we did our reading at Russell Books.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun times. And then went to Ontario in
Was that your first reading from the book?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so exciting.
Yeah. And then we went to Ontario in November, went to Picton, where I stayed with my publisher, Lee Nash of Invisible Books. And it was very nice just staying with her family and her partner, who's also a poet, Andrew Faulkner, and their little kid, Martha. It was very nice. It's probably my favorite part of the tour, staying, being their kid for a couple of days.
That is always
like,
nice.
Keep me here forever.
Well, and I think that's something people don't always know. Like, you know, you think a book comes out and author has a book, and so things are great.
Yeah.
And it's so expensive to tour, and having people that you can stay with is super important because, yeah, your publisher doesn't always have the money to help you out, and authors certainly don't always have the money to do that.
Yeah, that was one thing I was really just moved by on tour, just how many people were willing to help. And at the beginning of the tour in Toronto, I stayed with Erin Soros, who's a really great writer. And she's actually the one who had the immersion blender that I'd seen for the first time in my life. So when I got back, I immediately brought one. So Erin, thank you.
I like that you're buying a lot of like stick-based like kitchen tools. You're like,
mode.
Yeah, you're like, I'm going to crush this stuff. I'm going to froth. I'm going to blend. Just like someone might do with their makeup.
Yes.
Sorry.
That was a good connection.
Thank you. Cooking, makeup, etc. And did you go anywhere else in Ontario?
I went to Kingston, the university.
Oh,
town. Yeah. That was fun. I did an interview with Bruce Kaufman, who's lived in Kingston for a really long time. And he was very sweet. I did the interview with Lee. And he had a collection of rocks. And when I walked in, I immediately gravitated toward this orange brownish rock. And when I left, he was like, you should take half the rock. So I got the rock.
Oh, you got this beautiful stone. Mm-hmm. That's so sweet.
Yeah.
That can be the magic of touring too.
Totally.
Just meeting people for a short time, but having a really great experience. And, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I also had a really bad time.
Because
of the Airbnb. So I stayed with Erin for the first few days in Toronto. And then I was in an Airbnb on College Street. And the second last day before I came back to Vancouver, it was basically an Airbnb house. And the guy who was living in the room across from me, he tried to open my door at 3 a.m. and he was like banging the door. And I could see the deadbolt while he was banging. So it was like pretty hard. And he kept trying to open the door. And he's like, open up, open up. And I was like terrified. It was minus 17. I packed all my stuff. I was like ready to get out of the window. It was so scary. And then I got out. I took the first train out of there at 6 a.m. So
did he stop?
I call the host to give him a call and be like, what's going on? But it's very traumatizing because I was shaking, which I don't usually get that way. But my body was just like, I was so calm, but I was like shaking when that happened. So yeah, it's not cool.
Was there any explanation for that?
I don't think so. There was lots of explanations, like he was drunk or high, but he said he wasn't the next morning. And then when he came to apologize the next morning, he wasn't wearing any clothes.
Oh.
And it was just like a weird...
Was that part of the apology? It's like, hey, listen, I just wanted to show you this as like a form of apology. That's the worst form.
Yeah, nobody wants that.
It was, yeah, I just took the 6:05 train, first train out. So
where were you going after that?
Luckily, I hadn't given the keys back to Erin Soros.
Oh,
so I went right to her house.
Great.
Oh, that's good.
I know. I'm so lucky that, you know, I know her and she was able to accommodate me on tour because I don't know where I would have gone. I would have stayed at Tim Hortons. That was the backup plan. But it was, yeah, it was fucking scary.
That is extremely terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Oh, boy.
Also, like... Sorry, didn't mean to bring the phone down.
No, it's fine. But, like...
I've had good experiences with Airbnb every single time.
Right.
I've stayed in one.
Yeah.
But this was... It just happens. I ended up being in a bro house, and I should have checked, done more research. So.
Right. It is hard to figure that stuff out, though. Like, where should I go? And I don't know. I mean, that's the danger of these mostly unregulated types of accommodation.
Yeah. The similar thing happened, not like banging on the door, but I was staying at an actual like hotel in Toronto when I was on tour, and I don't remember what book it was. And there was these men, two men got on the elevator with me, and it was quite late. I'd been out doing something. I don't know. And they were getting really familiar with me in the elevator. So what ended up happening is I think... I pressed the elevator button for a different floor than mine and got off on a different floor. So they wouldn't know where I was going. And then I went back down to the lobby after I like lost them in the stairwell. And I went back down to the lobby and told the guy at the front desk that this was happening.
It sucks that we have to do so much paranoia and have so many tactics just at our disposal to evade all the scary stuff that could happen to us. It's so scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So annoying.
That happened to me in Toronto too when I was there for the Brown and Wall Sword, and it was me and Jen Neal. And this older businessman wouldn't leave us alone in the hotel bar. And we just like, we're staying on different floors. So I can't remember if one of us got out first and then walked up to the other floor. And then we just met up and hung out for a bit longer after that, just to make sure. Cause he obviously was like not going to get out of that elevator. And I was like, I mean, the other thing about this guy is I for sure could have taken him cause he was real small.
It doesn't even matter though about
that. Yeah,
it
doesn't
matter. But that's the other problem is I'm always like, oh, I kind of want to fight this person. And I'm like, don't do that. Then you're going to get arrested.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Even though he definitely deserved to be taken down a notch. Mm-hmm.
I will say that this particular hotel in Toronto, the front desk person was really nice and really tried to help me out.
A lot of people that work in hotels are great mm-hmm. about that because they've just seen so many terrible things happen. And mm-hmm. yeah, they, if they're good at their job, they know how to handle those kinds of situations.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad the rest of your tour was great.
Thank you, Dina. Thank you, Jen.
Touring is great, actually, when you get to read to people and meet readers and all of that stuff is super. It's actually, I think, my favorite part. Like, somebody was asking me, what's your favorite part of, like, promoting a book? And I said, oh, meeting readers, 100%. Mm-hmm. It's so great. Like, so great.
Yeah. The Toronto tour, oh, my God. The launch in Toronto, the Invisible launch, it was at the Imperial Pub, and I was just trying not to, you know, show my emotions on my face because that's the kind of person I am. I was, like, try not to cry. And just people had come out, Jagtar Atwal and Tamara Jung. They both came up from Cambridge for about an hour and a half. Aww. And we had dinner together, and Dominique Parisien also came out. And it was just all these people I got to meet. Del Cowie, who's the bibliophonic editor for Invisible, had a great chat with him about Moby and about all this 90s music. It was amazing.
I always want to talk about Moby.
Oh my God, let's talk about Moby.
This is our new segment. It's called Jen Sweater. Talks About Moby.
Your sweater, I feel Moby might wear.
Yes.
Actually.
I even have a Moby tote bag.
Do you have a Moby tote bag?
I do.
Wait, did you read the Moby book?
Porcelain?
Yeah.
Did he write a book?
Yeah.
What?
Can you give a quick review?
Porcelain is about Moby's coming of age in the DJ scene all across the world, mostly New York and the West Coast and other parts of the world. He's a pretty awesome dude. You know, he's gone through a lot of hard things and through recovery and through just being kind of a solitary person in a very busy social scene. So that was cool. I love Moby so much.
I mean, he seems like such a gentle soul.
Yeah.
And I dig it. Doesn't he have a tea restaurant?
He does.
Oh, for heaven's sake. He also has a book about the tea restaurant.
Do you know also, he looks a lot like my book bitch, Sean Krause. They look a lot alike.
So they look similar.
Yeah, they're similar. I enjoy Moby. I love how he seems to tread lightly on the earth. I think that's how I would describe him, leaving behind music.
It is nice to encounter a man who is treading lightly on the earth.
Mm-hmm. And he's vegan, right?
Yeah.
Of course he is.
So ethical.
Moby. Well, let's talk about your book. Debut full-length poetry collection, Port of Being. Shazia is chewing, I think, a cracker at the moment, but I can feel
time. We'll get there.
So how does it feel? Because we're just talking about you touring. And so now, because you've toured, you've seen the book out in the world, you've had an experience with the book out in the world. How does it feel when you look at the book physically? I always ask new authors, like, well, not new, but you've had like chapbooks and stuff, but I mean like an actual full length book, to see it physically for the first time. How did that feel for you?
To be honest, I was super dissociated.
That's a good take. I agree.
Let's hear about it.
Like, no one told me it would feel scary or that I would feel anxious or that I would just be so worried. But when I got the book, it took me at least like 2 days to feel excited. So when I saw it, I was just like in disbelief almost. I thought, you know, what is this? What have I done? What have I put out? I was having a lot of self-doubt, you know, thinking like, could I have done this differently? Is what I've done worth it? Why am I putting this out in the world? Just like extreme self-doubt. Mm-hmm. And I stayed home for a very long time, just trying to overcome that. Mm-hmm. But slowly, I think just doing the readings and being at the launch too, the Vancouver launch at Massey Books, I really started feeling things then, just to see, you know, the support and how people are there for me. And Dina was there.
It was a really beautiful launch.
Such warm feelings. And that was when I realized, you know, like I've come a long way in doing this. It's not something I just, you know, can dismiss and just like put out. Yeah, I was just having a lot of feelings of self-doubt, but later on they compacted and I was able to feel excited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's a weird thing, right? You live with this book or these poems and they're in your head for mm-hmm. a long time, just you and like whoever is reading them or helping you with them. And then the experience of having to present it to the world is requires a completely different set of skills.
Yeah.
Which with a lot of us don't have, actually. Mm-hmm. You haven't had a chance to, because you've been writing and you don't have a chance to develop that. And it can feel, I think, very strange.
Yeah. And I had to talk about the book too, which, you know, talking about poetry is a whole other set of problems, right?
But I don't know how to do it.
We're going to put you in training.
Okay.
Yeah. We're going to help you.
But 2020, Jen?
2020, fall 2020. It's true. I don't know how to talk about poetry, which I read it and I write it. I can't talk about it.
But you're getting there.
I'm trying. I'm really trying.
You are. I think you know also more than you think. And I think we all have more to say about our own work than we think that we do. Mm-hmm. And the way that we can talk about it is going to be different. Like some people are so much more academic than me. And I used to worry about that all the time because like I don't read a ton of theory anymore and I don't engage with work on that level. And I mean, I still feel that. I'm like, well, I was just talking to you before we started recording. I was talking about my book and I was like, it's so embarrassing. Like it's just full of jokes and weird
takes. I love
and
you. Like,
yeah, but it's, you start to kind of forget that you can be respected for doing different types of work and that it's okay. And, but you've been writing for a long time. You've been a part of the literary community in the city for a long time. You've done so many things.
Which is why people love you.
Yeah, which is why people love you and do want to support you and why your book is, I think, so exciting. I think we kind of do rally around people, especially because our community is a lot smaller. And I love that. I love that about being here. Like,
yeah, I felt it last night too. I read it, the Candy Tanaka's Dominion reading series.
Oh, yeah, Dominion.
And just every time I read from the book, people are so receptive and warm, and I'm always surprised. Like, it never stops surprising me just how willing people are to engage with some, like, heavy stuff that I've been reluctant to bring out, you know? So that's just very, very life-affirming to have these people in our community, like Candy and, like, other people.
Candy's great.
Yeah, Candy is great.
You can call her a friend of the podcast.
Candy's definitely a friend of the podcast.
Yeah, Candy.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I do really think that literary audiences in general are very receptive. Generally, if anyone who wants to go to a literary event, they open-minded, they want to hear new things, they want to consider heavy topics or not so heavy topics. They're very, I find, always really receptive. Mm-hmm. Right, Dina? You think?
And I agree. I think that I think we start to dismiss that and assume that audiences also want like one voice only. And that's also not true.
Not true at all.
They want many different types of voices. They want different tones. Mm-hmm. They want to have, and that's why I also think like when I'm planning readings and I'm programming, I'm thinking about that too. I'm like, I don't want the same voice to be permeating the whole event.
Well, that's just boring. Nobody wants
that. It is boring. Yeah. And even where you're putting people in the order, like you want to think about, you know, the work that someone is bringing and how is that going to speak to or contrast or compare with another person that they're going to read, you know, before or after. Mm-hmm. And I think Candy does a great job of that. That's why Dominion is a great reading series.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you get to talk about your process a little bit and then there's a Q&A afterwards and it's pretty open. Like I felt really happy yesterday because the people who were there, who were the partners of people who were reading, they were really interested in the work. So I was like flattered that, you know, people who weren't interested in poetry or didn't read it regularly were interested in what I had to say and were listening and were engaged. That was like surprising to me because I feel like usually it's people who are in the writing community, people who are readers actively, people who are writers, but random people who are not necessarily in the community asking about your work is a very fulfilling thing for me.
Yeah. And I actually really love when those events, when we do get to talk about writing process, actually, because that's like, I feel like a slam dunk topic for almost all writers. They love talking about their process or craft or, you know, how do you do this? Mm. And I do think that people who aren't writers are interested in process because I think it's very mysterious to people who aren't writers how we do what we do.
Yeah.
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 And also we're talking about ideas. It doesn't matter what the genre is, you know, it doesn't matter if it's mystery or if it's poetry or if it's true crime. It doesn't matter. Like, the ideas are still
thinking about true crime. Please continue.
I'm always thinking about it. True crime podcasts, so popular. We're changing this one right now to be more popular. This is about true crime.
Who took the stuffing out of Rosie's stuffed dog? Who? This is what this podcast is about.
Yeah. I guess it was Rosie, but it's hard to say. We're going to have to do a lot of investigative work.
Forensic evidence.
Yep. Yeah, I'm definitely going to do some paw print comparisons.
Can we use luminol? I mean, maybe not.
Yeah, we definitely... No, we can. We definitely can.
Go ahead.
I've got ultraviolet light, so we can scan the paw print.
Oh, you have ultraviolet light?
Yeah. Great.
So we're ready.
Weird. This is all shaped up.
This is also like... I like us as a detective team.
Oh, yeah.
Can we get trench coats?
Yeah.
Okay.
Speaking about craft or process, I loved your book so much. Mm-hmm. I was just going to say I was really struck by something, but I really felt like I was struck by every section. But I was really struck by the opening section.
The first one I was very close to my heart because I was basically walking around the city, walking around the waterfront specifically, and collecting snippets of overheard conversation. And then I would collect the impressions that came to me as I was walking. So the whole first section was written while I was walking, and my goal was to write the impressions as quickly as I could without interpreting them, just to capture the image as close to my body as I could. So it's this impressionistic technique that I was trying to work with to capture the surfaces of things and to see how meaning comes through on the surfaces and how surfaces play with each other. So that was one of the things that I was thinking through.
That's great. And then, so how did you make, like, aesthetically, some of the text is darker and some of it is kind of like a washed out.
Mm.
Yeah. So yeah. Do you want to talk about that a little bit as well?
Yeah. So the gray text at the tops of the pages in the first section are the overheard conversation. And the gray text at the bottom is an analogy to a different time. So it's outside of the poem, but it also echoes something that's happening within the poem. And I was hoping that it would be up to the reader to participate in making that narrative, to make those connections between the analogies that's happening in the poem and outside the poem. Because I feel like it's so important to historicize, but I didn't exactly want to like bang people over the head with like, this is what happened.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating. And I know that you talk about that like in the afterword about that. And I just found that extremely fascinating. And just as a follow-up, Port of Being has epigraphs and allusions, as you just mentioned, overheard conversations and references to sort of a variety of other texts. So for you, either what is the interest or the importance of using language that, I mean, all language is kind of coming from outside ourselves, but like paying sort of, but you also were acknowledging that in the work.
Mm-hmm. You're such a nerd. I love your questions.
She asks the best poetry questions, which I am always like, oh, this is so stupid. And like,
you're not, you're so smart.
I'm better with fiction, as you know, but like, yeah.
I feel like that's the understated quality that I love about Dina. It's just like, you know, underneath, she's like a super nerd.
Oh no, I am. Last night, or on Friday night, I definitely was totally boring people by talking again about the La Brea Tar Pits.
Present, or that the narrator was so present in setting. Which is specifically Vancouver specific. It's very specific. And I love that because let's talk about that. Like, because you're talking about, you know, listening to people or following people and being at the waterfront. By the way, Flags of Convenience is my favorite section.
Oh, wow.
Really
this
spoke
so
to me.
So surprising.
Yeah. So did you have to kind of force yourself to be really present in those settings in order to write this book? Because I know that for me, and I think maybe true for a lot of writers, we can sometimes live in our heads and not be super present.
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. And it's so cool that you've perceived that presence, because I feel like I was working really hard at it. I was really working hard to be present. I was going through some really difficult things. Essentially, I'm a recovered addict and I've experienced depression in the past. And what has helped me in the past is listening to people. Like, I usually make field recordings. I go out and just listen to the stream or the leaves or whatever. So this time, I was trying to get outside of my head because I just left a job and everything that I'd repressed previously about an incident that had happened to me. Okay, I should just say it. So a couple of years ago, a guy stole my laptop and my phone from my Vancouver house, East Vancouver house, and he followed me for about 5 or 6 months afterwards. And so he knew where I was going and he could see what time I came home and stuff like that. So I tried to repress it. And it all came up for me just the year that I was writing the book and the year that I quit my job. And so I was really depressed and I was like looking for a reason to get outside of myself. Yeah. I knew that I had to listen, but I couldn't because sometimes it's really hard to get motivated when you're depressed, right? And then I came upon Vito Acconci's following piece, which is a work of performance art where he followed people in the streets of New York until they reached a private space. So he followed them for minutes, for hours. All of this, bringing all of this together, that was what motivated me to go out and follow people. And it really forced me to come outside of my head, to get on myself and put myself back into the world to find relation. So yeah, it's like I'm still getting nervous talking about it right now. But yeah.
Well, I think though that like in the book anyway, there seems to me that the act of being present in setting is actually a much more interior act than it can appear because you're being present in the external world, but it's also about placing yourself in relation. Am I making any sense at all? I'm trying to be smart. Well, I feel this in the book though. Like there is it's a very sort of inner and intimate act, even though it's external.
That makes me so happy.
Oh, yeah. Well, good. I'm glad.
I agree. I had a very similar reaction because I think this book really explores both internal and external space, like mental health, the physical world that we inhabit, the space people take up, what does take up space and in our own heads, what doesn't. And like the title also, Port is a Place, but it also makes you think about computer ports and the ways that we are connecting and like all these spaces and places and plugins and opportunities for connection or disconnection are so present. You are extremely smart.
I feel worried because I feel like I'm so smart in this book, but I'm not that smart anymore.
Last year. Do you feel like you purged it into the book?
Yeah,
I have that feeling after every book. This is going to happen to you after every book. You're gonna.
It is kind of true.
It's true. You're going to promote the book. People are going to say, ask you very smart questions. And you're going to be like, I am that smart. I totally intended to do that. And then after that's over, you're going to be like, I'm so stupid. Yeah. I don't know if I can do it again. It happens every time. Exactly. It happens every time.
But I think it's because... And you can both also speak to this. When you're in it, you, even if you are trying to get outside of yourself to do some of the writing and to understand the world, whether it's character, whether it's an idea, when you're doing it, you're so in it that you, that love, I feel like sometimes that level of immersion makes you feel like you get it. And then when you're done, you're like, well, I don't know about this. Who wrote this? Who was doing this?
Because I felt like it was so much bigger than me. And then when it finally got recognized, I was like, what?
Yeah.
It was very surprising just to have these very in-depth, immersive experiences be seen. So I was scared about how I'm going to speak about it because it felt like such an involved process of like waking up every day at 6 a.m, walking the city for like hours, writing down things, and then going home and reading the theory parts of it to bring it all together and to try to articulate it to myself. So it was just very, yeah.
But then articulating it to yourself is not the same as having to articulate it to other people.
Yeah.
Because there's a translation that has to happen because articulating to yourself is a whole other kind of, it depends on how your brain is working and how you make connections in here. But having to explain that to other people is a whole other barrel of chickens. I don't know. I just chose an animal.
It's a barrel of dead koi.
R.I.P. koi.
Yeah. I feel like I really realized that, you know, that, discrepancy when I had to talk about the book. And I was like, how am I going to talk about this without talking about the theory? But I didn't want to talk about it in terms of the academic stuff I was reading because it only makes sense to me in my head, right? So I realized I had to talk about the process to a way of talking about the book and how it came into being because the process is so much a part of the book too. So
I think though that I think people are interested in like the theory or the academic side as well. And again, I do feel like that is also a different delivery system to be able to talk about that part of process as opposed to some of the other things.
Right.
That
Yeah, I felt like I distinctly didn't want to talk about it just personally in terms of, you know, academic language.
I just wanted to ask you, because you, as I already mentioned, have done a lot of literary things before the book came out, including having a chapbook published, but also you've done so many readings. Like, you've read at events that I've programmed so many times. I've been very lucky to have you as part of events.
You gave me my big break. You know that?
What was your big break?
Then Dina and Daniel were editing the Vancouver Poets Folio, and they had an event at Project Space, I think, when it was, across the Brixton.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I went out and met everyone, and people were talking about the work, and I met all these other people who I'd seen just on the internet. And I was like, sure, I'm just going to pretend I've been a part of this for the longest time. And so that was, that was me coming out of my bedroom into the world.
It was amazing.
Thank you, Dina.
That's the magic of Dina, though. She does that. She was amazing. Yeah. Your poems were so good. I loved working with Daniel on that folio.
Yeah.
Like, we really got to publish so many emerging poets that, that now are doing great things. They're creating their own presses. They're publishing all over the place. They're doing their own work. And it's really beautiful and awesome.
I feel like when I'm editing too, right now I'm working with Hassan Namir, whose poetry book is coming out with Book Hug.
It's called
War Torn. Yeah.
I just hung out with Hassan the other day.
He's so sweet, isn't he?
He's a sweetheart. Yeah. Him and his husband were wearing like super over-the-top holiday outfits. And I was...
Is that who that was?
Yeah.
I saw the picture.
And I was dying of happiness. I was like, best. You're both the best.
Yeah, I saw the pictures. Like, Dina's probably partying it up with them right now.
I was.
Those were great Christmas sweaters they had on.
They were so amazing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He had the Home Alone sweater.
Yeah.
Merry Christmas, you filthy animal. Yeah. And he had a glowing hat. This is what Canlit's really about. Holiday sweaters, sparkly hats. So you're working with Hassan right now.
Yeah. And I'm working with Hassan right now. And I'm always trying to, find the things that are most emotionally pressing for them. And I feel like it's a really intuitive thing that can't really be articulated in craft, but it's something that people sense or that I can sense. And so I just sort of ask them questions that urges them towards the emotionally difficult things that may be only just touched in the manuscript, and then try to develop that very carefully.
That's great.
It's very nurturing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes I will ask for like a harder critique.
Ooh.
I'll be like, you got to be a real dick about this poem.
Yeah.
Because I know that I'm not doing what I need to be doing, but I don't know how to get there. Mm-hmm. So my track changes are really funny. They could be their own book.
I haven't been edited yet for my poetry book. So I'm like curious how that's going to go. I've been edited so many times for prose, right? But like poetry, it's Paul Ramirez, friend of the podcast, former guest, who's editing my book. And I'm like a tiny bit scared, not of him, just of the process. Yeah.
No, it is. It's very different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So since it's the holidays, I wanted to bring in some holiday cheer, but I couldn't really figure out what to do. And then I had this idea that would be about one of my favorite segments. What do you think about Gritty?
Because we love Gritty.
Are you familiar with Gritty?
Mm-mm, no.
Great. So I'm going to ask you the question. Gritty is the mascot for the NHL hockey team, the Philadelphia Flyers, but also he is now an Antifa hero.
Was the night before Gritmas, and all through the house, all the creatures were stirring except Dina's dead louse. Fishnet stockings hung on the shower rod with care, in the hopes that no one would see them drying there. The writers were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of things they said at literary events danced in their heads. And Dina in her flannels and Jen in her sweats could not settle down, so they ate some baguettes. When in the back alley there arose such a clatter, they sprang up from their rants to see what was the matter. Away to the window they glanced out to see, past the streetlights, dumpsters, and a drunk man's fresh pee. The rain-splattered pavement was shiny and slick, and they refilled their glasses, and they did it quick. Then what to their wondering eyes did appear but a large orange being, for fluffy and bright, his googly eyes gleaming in the dark of the night, his Antifa shirt, his window-throwing brick, they knew in a moment it must be St. Grit.
Comes off his shoulder and flies into the sky to spread joy everywhere.
Oh, I don't know what street the stadium is that the Flyers play on, but you could change the name of it to Miracle on whatever that street is. And then Gritty is there. We only have one question left for you, Shazia. What can't you with?
Oh. The thing that really bothers me a lot, my new sweatpants.
Thank you for being our guest.
Thank
Wonderful
you so
guest.
Much, Dina and Jen. I've wanted to be part of this podcast since you guys began.
Yay!
So nice.
We're so happy to have you. Great conversation. What if... Wait, I think I hear Gritty. Okay, we gotta go!
Bye!